Hello and welcome to the Counting the Earth podcast from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Alice Hope.
And I'm Sue Nelson. Now, you may be able to tell from the sound of running water in the background that we are not in the studio today. We've broken out the Wellington boots and our warmest coats and come to a rather waterlogged field in the Cotswolds in the aftermath of Storm Bert in late November to record the whole podcast.
We'll be discussing leaky dams, sediment retention ponds, field corner buns, and much, much more. Because in this podcast, we'll be exploring natural flood management, which is the use of a range of soft engineered measures designed to work with natural processes to reduce and manage the risk of flooding, as opposed to building hard flood defences that people might be more familiar with.
To find out what that involves and if it works, we've come to the Bruin Estate in Oxfordshire, which is the site of one of 60 pilot projects investigating this approach that were part of a government initiative launched in 2017. And with the whole country somewhat battered and deluged by Storm Bert over the last couple of days, we couldn't have picked a better time to come and to see how the flood management measures here have stood up to probably their biggest test since they were put in place.
This alternative approach is of increasing interest as we face up to the impacts of climate change and the rising risk of flooding to homes and businesses. Latest figures show that 5.7 million properties in England are now at risk from rivers, the sea, surface water or groundwater. And that number will be our foundation for this episode, as we look at how nature can help reduce the risk for some of these 5.7 million properties.
And no doubt many more in other parts of the UK. Well, shortly we'll be getting a guided tour of the impressive array of natural flood management measures put in place at this one site by Wild Oxfordshire, who run a number of such projects in this area. And we'll also take a look at the monitoring that's in place here to assess if natural land management measures really do reduce flooding.
Lots to see and learn about today. But before we get into the microcosm of this site, we wanted to understand more about the big picture and to explain why there is a growing interest in going back to a more natural approach to flood management. We are joined by UKCH hydrologist Dr. Alejandro Dusayunt. Alejandro, we are talking about management rather than defences, aren't we? How do the two approaches differ?
Well, the traditional way of dealing with water was get it out of your land as soon as possible, defend yourself from the flood. But now we understand that we have to have a much more holistic approach where we look at a catchment-based approach, looking at ways of not only defending or moving water away, but also understanding that water has a function, an ecological function, and also find ways of adapting to extremes, including, for example, storing water in areas where we can and not creating a problem downstream, which was the usual problem when we just were worried about taking the water out of the land.
When Alison and I were walking towards you across a slightly waterlogged field here, we saw that you were using some shears on some branches, and there's a sort of stream filling up quite considerably behind us from what looks like the field. What were you actually up to?
We are continuing here some work initiated in 2017 when these measures were installed and monitored. We're continuing the monitoring longer term, and here we're just doing some maintenance on the sensors that do that monitoring. That includes clearing some vegetation so the solar panels could get some sunlight.
Oh, so multitasking there, and we'll hear more about the monitoring in a moment. Now, our headline number for this episode is 5.7 million, which is the number of homes and businesses at risk of flooding, and that's just in England. Now, we've seen a number of big flood events in recent years, particularly in this area, and we clearly have a growing problem. Why is that?
Well, people listening would know that climate change has increase the number, the frequency, and the magnitude of extreme events, including droughts and floods. But also there's an impact of how we manage the land, and a combination of a land use change and that climate change, and people perhaps inhabiting or using the land in places where it's not the best to do that because they're used to floods or they're going to flood again. The combination of those three factors makes us more at risk.
So we'll shortly be seeing for ourselves some of the measures involved in natural flood management. But a lot of it seems to be about putting the land back to a more natural state, putting bends back in rivers and planting trees and letting the fields soak up water rather than doing all you can to rush water off the land, just like you said. So did we just get things sort of spectacularly wrong in the past? Is this about rolling back a lot of sort of hasty post-war changes?
It's difficult to judge. You have to put yourself in the boots, since we're using Wellington boots today, of the people at that time. And of course, there was a big push to get food from the land. And therefore, you needed land to do that. And the yields were lower, so you needed more land. But now that we have a totally different context and where we have depleted the natural capital of our landscape, it's very important that we can recognize the role of water in the landscape and how that water also feeds into other functions, including socioeconomic ones that we can actually tap into so that we get to a better balance, let's say, with natural functions and societal functions.
And this approach is gaining quite a bit of traction, isn't it?
Yes, not only because of water, but this natural flood management schemes or nature-based solutions, to talk more in general, bring co-benefits that sometimes are more important even than the water capture for floods and droughts, including what you see here, habitat for biodiversity, water quality, positive impacts, and amenity and well-being for people who can actually walk around these features and enjoy their day.
That's our overview, but it's time to see these measures in action. So we're now heading across these soggy fields to meet Anne Barclay from Wild Oxfordshire, the organisation that manages the project here on the Bruin Estate.
Hello, Anne. Nice to meet you.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Now, you're standing beside what looks like a sort of beaver's dam, really, because there is a big mound of leaves and twigs stopping up this stream. Is there anything underneath the leaves?
Yes, that's our leaky woody dam. So that's made of big bits of timber that we embed into each side of the bank of the brook. And the leaves have just got caught on it. Originally, you could see it was just timber, but there's a gap underneath so that normal flows will go underneath the dam. The reason that we have this dam is when the brook levels come up, we find it very difficult to push water out of the brook into temporary storage areas, and so we need this mechanism to make the water go slightly higher so it can be pushed out into the fields. And we've cut these swales, which are just shallow channels into the bank, that then direct the water down the side of the field. And if you see, the water's flowing now, and as it makes its way down the field, it's getting stored temporarily in the buns that we've created at the corner of the field.
You used the word bun there, which I must admit my first thought was a cake tin. But what exactly is it?
Yes, I think that's a bunt, isn't it?
Yes, there's an extra T in there. Yeah.
So a bund is literally a bank of earth that we create at the corner of a field. So if you can think of like your arm hugging the corner of a field, that gives that raised area that water will be held up with.
So it is very natural. It's no special equipment. It's just as simple as digging a bit of a dip in a field.
Yes, we always use everything that's on site and it stays on site. So the only thing that we had to bring in was a bit of pipework and some free-draining stone so that these temporary storage areas will drain down. It's really important that we empty them gradually back into the brook so they remain empty, ready for the next big rain event.
And if all this water wasn't here in this temporary bund, where would it be?
So all of that water would have been down in Milton. There's a real bottleneck there at Church Road where there's a culvert that's quite narrow, and that then backs up and floods those houses there. And it's those houses that all of this natural flood management work has been done in order to try and protect them from flooding.
So with the swales, these channels and the bunds and the dams, there's been quite a lot of work done here. So what was it like before the pilot project, and what were the problems that this site was facing?
Both the fields have always been arable fields, and we're on a clay substrate, so they're very, very claggy. And the bottom end of both these fields was identified by the estate manager as really problematic areas to grow crops on. They sat really wet. It collects a lot of surface water runoff. These are very big fields.
And this is part of wider work that's actually going on in this area.
Yes, yeah, so the whole natural flood management project was very much designed hand in hand with the estate manager here. So he identified which areas would be really ideal for doing these temporary storage areas. And these are the very same areas that the bunds have been built on. So, you know, the farmer knows best, to be honest.
Absolutely.
What other measures are there on this site?
So further up, we've got some inline ponds that we have created to try and drop out the nutrients and sediment that's coming with the runoff from the fields, so that when that is then put back into the brook, it's much cleaner and doesn't have the nutrient load that it otherwise would have. So we're trying desperately to keep nutrients on the land. And actually, that's exactly the same thing that's working here in the field corner bunds. Because the water's slowed, the nutrients and the sediment will drop out and they'll remain on farm.
Shall we go and take a look at them?
Great idea.
Okay, I can see some water ahead of us, a lot smaller and rounder than the bunds in the corner of the field.
Yeah, so this is a proper pond, which we constructed in a watercourse that we opened up from a culvert so that it ran down the centre of the field in its natural topographical location. And we built three of these inline ponds to try and trap the sediment and nutrients, so the water leaving at the far end is cleaner when it rejoins the brooks.
And can you test that?
So we had a PhD student working on this, and he found that the top pond stored the most nutrient and sediment, and surprise, surprise, the second one down slightly less, and the bottom one less again. So there's a kind of cleaning action by having these ponds in a series.
So you mentioned that this is the natural course for the brook. And we know that during the Second World War, there was a big drive to really increase the productivity of farmland. And these kind of initiatives do take land away. But is that why the brook was kind of redirected in the first place?
Yeah, so it was to make the field bigger and easier for the bigger farm machinery to operate. And it was also under-drained with pipes so that the clay soil would actually dry out faster, making these clay very unprofitable soils into decent arable soils for food production.
We're actually surrounded by very young trees, all in there. I don't know what the technical name is, but they look like the sort of piping that you put at the bottom of the sort of trunks to protect them. Has it made a difference to this land at all?
The interesting thing about these trees is we've planted them primarily so that the roots will penetrate through the clay soils, and we should get more water infiltration in this field going forward. Also, because it's now not arable under the trees, we've got permanent grass, which will help the coarseness of surface flow. So it'll slow down surface flow as well as help penetration. And we had to plant all of these trees in this field, interestingly, because it was part of a countryside stewardship scheme, and the only way we were able to implement these measures was if we turned it into a woodland creation.
We've got trees, we've got ponds, we've got corner bunds, and we've got swales, and that's an awful lot of work to protect, as you said earlier, the houses in Milton under Wychwood, to give it its full name. Do we know if this is having any other impacts further downstream as well?
So all of these, although small measures, will have an accumulative effect downstream. I think we want to put in more natural flood management measures everywhere so that we can see an effect in the Evenload Valley itself.
You must be quite pleased, though, in the way it's performed so far with Storm Bert. I mean, yes, I saw loads of fields flooded on the train on the way here, but there doesn't seem to be so far any huge issues in this particular immediate area, although I know the storm has caused quite a bit of damage elsewhere.
Yes, so Milton under Whitwood, they have been incredibly fortunate. Apparently, yesterday afternoon, they had all the sandbags out. The stream was right up to the edge of their sandbags and they were sweeping continuously to push the water away. So they have literally just missed being flooded this time round. And it will have been because of these measures, because we know that Bledington, they've flooded very badly, as has Ascot further down the Evenload. So yes, these measures have had an effect.
Do we know roughly how much water has been prevented from moving further downstream by these measures?
The bund that we were looking at earlier, that stores 1,700 cubic metres of water. That was totally full when we were looking at it. In total, all of the measures put together, if they were filled to capacity, would be 30,000 cubic metres of water.
I can't picture that, but I should imagine that's an awful lot of Olympic swimming pools, which is usually the sort of common person's unit of measurement when it comes to water.
Yeah, I don't know how much an Olympic swimming pool is, I'm afraid.
No, but it's a lot. We'll work that out, won't we?
Yeah, that's a massive amount of water that's not been pushed downstream. So that's obviously a really big benefit for people. But are there any other benefits from doing these schemes?
So we talked about the nutrients and sediment stored in these online ponds. And the PhD student, John Rowbotham, did a calculation for the amount of soil stored within 2 to 3 years of over the whole catchment by all of the interventions that we have installed. And he calculated 83 tonnes of soil had remained on the land and 122 kilograms of phosphorus had remained on the land. Now, that is really important because that going into the brooks is causing real water quality issues further down the catchment, and it really disturbs the ecology. So keeping these brooks clean is really important. The other thing that we have found is we did an ecological survey and they came up with over 600 species of insects, that's aquatic and terrestrial. And don't forget, all of this was just arable land before. 22 of them were nationally scarce. So that's a really good result.
Our headline number for this episode is 5.7 million for the number of properties in England that are at risk from flooding. Do projects like this have a role to play across the country and further into the rest of the UK?
I think they definitely do. Obviously, everything depends on where that flooding is and what you can do with it. But in these upper catchments, we can hold an awful lot of water back, even just by changing our land use. That would make a huge difference.
Using the land, trees, vegetation, these natural measures to slow the water down and act like temporary sponges at times of high rainfall seems an obvious approach to the unpredictable weather patterns that we have nowadays. But it's important we have rigorous monitoring of the impacts of these early projects to know if they really do work before we roll the natural flood management approach out on a wider scale.
Now, this is where Alejandro and his team from UKCEH come in. Here at Bruin and across the projects in the Evenload catchment, they've been to assess whether projects like this really do have the expected impact. Alejandro, we're back with you and some members of the team here. Who are you, please?
Ponamblam Rameshwaran.
Neeraj Sah.
Manuel Angel Duenas.
Quite an international team, isn't there? So what's going on here in a bit more detail?
Here we are trying to continue the good work of the Evenload NFM, the Littlestock Brook NFM in particular, that started in 2017 and for many years very comprehensively monitor these installed measures of NFM with...
And when you mean NFM, you mean...
Natural Flood Management, with the idea of, okay, we cannot monitor everything, but at least monitor in the longer term whether these measures continue functioning with the same effectiveness and whether the monitoring and maintenance is important. And with more events like Stormbird that happened this past weekend.
So Neeraj, when we got here, you were in your waders in the brook, fiddling around with something that looks like it's got a solar panel on it on a pole. What was it that you were doing there?
It's a low-cost ultrasound sensor, which measures the distance between the sensor and the river level. So actually, we are monitoring the river level here and across the little stock brick. So we have 9 similar sensors installed throughout this river reach to measure the water level.
It looks quite cold work, I must say.
It is. Yeah, you should have come last Thursday.
Was it even worse, was it?
This field corner bund and the ultrasound sensors aren't the only measures you have here, are they? Shall we go and have a look at what else you're doing on this site?
Sure, yeah, we can go and see what we're doing with the soil surveys.
Well, I'm glad I've got my wellies on, I'll say that. Neeraj, you're parked here, quite literally, with what looks like a giant syringe, don't you think, Alice? In a sort of, I would say like an assassin's bag, not a rifle, but a huge syringe, as well as some other poles.
Yeah, we've got sort of some pipe work and then something that sort of looks like an open cylinder on a stick. So Neeraj, what are we looking at here?
What you're looking at is a Guelph permeameter. It's an instrument used to measure percolation, which in general term is the rate of flow of water inside the soil.
Now, you could hear my squelching as yes. I walked over there. How do you put all this together? Just show me what goes where.
Yes. So we dig a hole first. So we measure the percolation rate at different depths in the soil. For example, 25 centimeter. If it was not wet today, we would have done that.
So, it's too wet then to even use. Wow.
Yes, it's too wet to even use today.
Now, you've got the syringe part and a tripod. So, you're getting some other bits together. Explain what you're doing.
Okay, so this small air tube fits in the bigger air tube. We fill the big syringe that you're looking with water.
So, yeah, it is like a syringe, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And then once we fill the water in, we sort of drain that water into the big hole and we measure the rate of flow of the water inside the soil until it becomes steady.
And I can see little markings, measurement markings on the
yes.
side.
This is to adjust the head, which decides like how much water would flow into the soil, which we determine beforehand.
And why do you do this?
This is quite important. So we measure the saturated rate of flow of water in the soil. So when the soil gets saturated, how the water flows into the ground. It's important to find the infiltration rate as well. If the percolation rate is higher, that means the rain will infiltrate quickly into the soil and then there will be less water going into the river and other people's homes.
So the looser the soil is, the more water is going to drain through and the less it's going to flood further downstream. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Ramesh, you've worked on this site from the very beginning. What have you learned at this site? And does it look like the changes that have been made over the last 6 years or so are making a positive difference?
Yeah, understanding the hydrological functioning of the natural flood management intervention is very important in order to learn their functionality. The study showed that the natural flood management intervention successfully reduced the flood peaks by up to 55%.
Wow, that's a lot.
We are still waiting for the yesterday's storm events. That seemed to be one of the extreme storm events so far.
Yeah, 55% is a really big amount to reduce that down by. So we've got a lot of monitoring in. We've obviously got a lot of different natural flood management techniques. So from a scientific perspective, Alejandro, what questions are we trying to answer with this study?
Well, as we have discussed, natural flood management is something that's relatively new. So one of the things we don't understand yet is how these nature-based solutions evolve in time. So it's the temporal question, the longevity question, whether they need to be maintained and how, and monitored so as to be maintained and how. The second one is the spatial question, is whether a combination of measures, what is the overall effect downstream and in a larger catchment. The third question is whether these measures have co-benefits that sometimes are even more important than the flood management that we discussed before, like, for example, water quality, habitat for biodiversity. But also there might be unintended consequences or trade-offs, and we need to understand those so that we design these with proper knowledge.
Well, Anne was in no doubt that these sort of measurements and management would have benefits in a wider area. Do you feel the same? Do you feel this is the start of something that could really make a big difference elsewhere?
Yes, I believe so. But as I said before, it's very important to understand the local context. The catchment from a physical standpoint, from a biological standpoint, and also from a socioeconomic standpoint. We need to understand how to motivate landowners and farmers to install these measures, but also install the proper ones and in the proper places such that they work sustainably in time.
With all of these measures that have been put in place here, does that mean that we aren't going to need those physical sort of hard flood defences anymore? Can we just put corner buns and swales in everywhere?
Leaky dams.
Leaky dams, of course, can't forget the leaky dams. Does that mean the age of flood walls and hard flood defences is over?
Not really. I think it's more about complementing and, as they say, green when we can and grey when we must, in the sense that they are sometimes where for really large events and for protecting of human life and property, we need to have those traditional engineer measures as a safeguard. But definitely if we install more of these natural flood management and nature-based solutions, the stress on those traditional measures will reduce, the cost of the maintenance of those traditional measures will also be reduced, and we will get benefits that sometimes, as I mentioned before, might be even more important than the flood reduction or drought alleviation.
Well, we've left the team to get on with their very important work, but we do have one more stop on our tour of this project, and that is to see what these measures are actually protecting. We've come about 1.5 kilometres, as the water flows, down the Littlestock Brook to Milton-under-Wychwood, one of the three villages on the site of what was the ancient Royal Hunting Forest of Wychwood.
And we're on a sort of tiny bridge, although you wouldn't know it if you drove over it in your car, but underneath it is the brook, and around us are a collection of houses in that gorgeous honey-coloured stone that's very typical of the Cotswolds. And Littlestock Brook actually just looks like a fast but fairly gentle stream at the moment, and it's hard to believe that it must be only about 2 to 3 metres across, could be such a flood risk.
It is hard to believe, but there are some clues. We've got a monitoring station here and also a little step in the wall, and we can see some silt and sediment that's been left there from when the water levels receded from earlier in the day. And this brook does fill up very, very quickly, meaning that the flood risk can change quite quickly as well.
But as Anne said, perhaps normally at a time like this after a storm, this place would have expected to have had severe flow. So obviously something is going right. And I was really interested and sort of heartened by the fact that they're going back to nature. This natural flood management does involve some very sensible measures that are not too intensive in terms of cost, but they're working.
Absolutely, but those natural flood management measures that we saw are part of a wider network of solutions. And I really liked Alejandro's phrase of green when you can and grey when you must. Natural flood management is part of the solution. It's not a silver bullet on its own.
And these natural approaches, it's much more sort of a harmonious solutions with the countryside than sort of hard defences, and it's not just obviously for floods as well that you can use these sort of methods. You can help in times of drought and retaining water across the year.
And I think the other thing that I really took is how much we still don't know about how effective some of these measures are, and that's why monitoring, particularly taking into account the local context of the catchment you're working in, is so important, and why UKCH keeps doing the work that it's doing.
We've really zoomed in for this episode to look how an individual project can manage the flood risk for one community, but multiply these effects across a river's catchment across the country, and hopefully we might start making inroads into our number for this podcast, the 5.7 million properties in England now at risk from flooding.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us next time for another look at nature through numbers.